Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So thinking of storm-stalled Isaac down there in the southern part of the country and the 7 years that have passed since Hurricane Katrina, the story of where resilience comes from. In July of 2005, Daniel Aldrich and his wife were doing pretty well. They just moved to New Orleans with their two young children. They bought a new home, new car. Daniel had landed his first teaching job as a professor. 6 weeks later, all of it changed. Hurricane Katrina struck. Daniel and his family found themselves fleeing New Orleans all of a sudden for Houston, Texas, leaving behind everything they owned. The experience inspired Daniel, a political science professor, to study how communities respond to natural disasters. Taking an academic journey around the world, researching as far as India and Japan, Daniel Aldrich is associate professor of political science at Purdue University, author of Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery. He joins us now from Silver Spring, Maryland. 7 years ago, does it seem like a long time, Daniel?
Actually, listening to reports of Isaac, it feels like yesterday.
No kidding. So let's tell your story first and then talk about your journey of discovery here. In a sense, as you become confronted with a disaster, you're passing through sort of circles of reality where expectations suddenly are found to be unrealistic or just completely wrong or swept away entirely. What happened to you?
So we had moved down in July of 2005 to New Orleans and spent 6 very good weeks with our friends there, our family, our new Jewish community in New Orleans until the end of August, when we noticed on a Friday afternoon our friends nearby were packing up their cars. And we asked them what was going on. We didn't really listen to the radio that much or the TV at much at the time. And they told us that a storm was coming and they were going to go evacuate for 3 days. So we had just moved in. We had just established our home. We had no intention of leaving. Saturday passed. People kept leaving our neighborhood. And by around 10 p.m. Saturday night, we were one of the few families, I think, left nearby. And a neighbor came over to us and knocked on our door and said, "You should really leave. Take with you 3 days of clothing, maybe some toys for your kids. You'll be back by Tuesday. It'll be no problem." So we talked about it for a while, tried to find a hotel room in Houston on the phone, which was a pretty long process. So by 3 a.m. Sunday morning, we had packed our car with one day of clothes, a suitcase, a hot pot for some cooking, and put our kids in the car and tried to drive out of New Orleans to Houston. We were joined by 1 million other New Orleanians also heading west. All the roads in New Orleans, I-10, were counterflowed to go west toward Houston. So rather than being a 4-hour journey to Houston, it was a 14-hour journey, which was pretty intense on us at the time. We had no idea what was going on. We finally got to Houston. Everything seemed fine. The rain slowed down in New Orleans. And people Monday morning were packing up to head back to New Orleans. But then around 10 a.m. on Monday morning, the news came over the TV that we were all watching at the time. And the TV told us that there was water in the streets. And slowly but surely, we recognized the levee had broken near our house in Lakeview. And there were about 15 feet of water in our home by Monday afternoon. So we recognized by Monday night that we were not going to go home anytime soon.
And as that reality sort of, you know, settles in, what sort of mechanisms switch on in you, in your family, and then extrapolate to whole communities as people begin to make the decisions that are all part of the chain of events called recovery?
Well, my first response was to call FEMA and to try and register for help. We had not yet activated insurance in our home, so we had no coverage on our goods that were damaged, and our car was a total write-off. So I figured the government could help us. We actually didn't hear back from the government until March of 2006. So we had a lot of radio silence going on. But then our friends and our friends of friends and synagogues and the communities around the country began to email us. And our mailbox filled up with offers of a place to stay as far away as California and Pennsylvania, offers of a new job, just for temporarily at least, a place to stay in Harvard, offers of things to do with our children, offers of school, tuition to be paid by communities. We recognized very quickly that we had a tremendous amount of support from people that we'd never met, people who had just heard about our problems, people who are friends of our family or friends of our friends of our synagogue back in Boston. And that for me was the eye-opening experience, recognizing that at a time of crisis, what really comes through for us isn't our own financial situation. We had little money saved in the bank. It wasn't insurance. We didn't have that at all. And it wasn't the government. It was really the social capital, the connections to people nearby.
We're talking with Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University, author of Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery. So as an academic, you set out to determine whether this support network that showed up in your email box was unique to either the Jewish community, the American community. You were trying to sort of establish some social norms for what you were seeing benefiting you personally.
Exactly. I wanted to see if my story, our story as a family, our story as a community was mirrored by the experiences in Japan after the Kobe earthquake in 1995, in Tamil Nadu, India, after the 2004 tsunami there. I wanted to see how familiar others were with this concept that it really isn't the government, it really isn't the private sector. At the end of the day, what's going to save us, what's going to help us out in terms of disasters will be these connections.
And how did that manifest itself in India or Japan differently or similarly to what you found in the United States?
No, the forms of the networks are quite different. You know, here in America, most of us are, if we're lucky, members of a club or a church or a synagogue. We have official and formal connections. In India, many of the connections that were formed were quite informal. There were very few clubs that I saw, at least in rural India. But rather, people participated in other ways. There are large weddings that were held, and oftentimes the whole village would go to a wedding. Religious ceremonies as well, and funerals often formed ways to connect. And we actually measured, we asked people regularly how often they attended these kind of events, these social events that could be quite sad, like a funeral, but involved the entire community. And we found individuals before the disaster who were better connected through these kind of social events in India were exactly the ones after the disaster, able to access aid, able to feel that their lives are more put together, able to get into temporary housing. They used these connections they had formed before the storm, before the tsunami destroyed their village, to help leverage their lives afterwards.
So the connections are part of an actual mechanism for delivering aid and getting help, but they're also a psychological reminder that you're not alone, which is sort of the key to taking action on your own behalf.
Exactly. Some of the saddest stories I heard in my research came from Kobe, Japan, where after the 1995 earthquake, the government wanted to help the elderly and the infirm and provide them with housing immediately. So they were whisked away from their damaged homes and placed in large-scale apartment complexes, Japanese called danchi, which was a great idea. They wanted to help them first. But unfortunately, by moving these elderly victims to places where they had no friends, no family, they had no routines, they didn't know doctors or businesses nearby. We have records of over 240 people passing away from what's called the kodokushi, or lonely deaths. That is, they were safe and sound, it's true. They were far from the disaster, but they had little to live for. All the things that made their lives normal and special were gone. So that was one program I found that meant well, but unfortunately interfered with the way that social capital works.
You know, as political scientists, anthropologists, academics of all kinds who study human behavior, you know, we like to think of governments as representative of some deeper set of values, a social contract, whatever. In your research, did you find governments amplifying and aiding in pre-existing social networks and connections or getting in the way?
You know, I found a mix. Some cities in America, Seattle, San Francisco among them, have really worked hard to build resilience at the community level. Rather than telling citizens, okay, buy 3 days of food, right, get some water for your home. It's all good advice, of course. But they're telling the people, look, let's get together in a block party. Let's meet our neighbors. Let's get out of our homes and learn who needs what, which neighbors need wheelchairs or diabetes medicine, which neighbors have special needs. So Seattle and San Francisco stand at the forefront right now of really trying to get resilience down to the community level. In Japan as well, they've changed the evacuation procedure away from hurrying out the elderly and infirm to moving people, if they can, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. So now after the tsunami last year in Japan, many villages didn't move people individually, but rather did their best to place them together with families. So I think we're seeing governments around the world making an attempt to recognize the power of these networks.
That's an amazing, hopeful story. Is that the sort of sense you got from this research?
I did. In fact, for me, the best story is that if social capital is so important, I also found it's like any other capital. It can be moved, increased, and decreased as well. So we actually have several programs that are being tried out now around the world that actually can increase social capital in communities. And these have been tested in field experiments in Nicaragua, in South Africa, and they're even in Japan as well. And we found them to be really quite effective at increasing the stock people have in trust in each other and in their ability to work together.
Amazing. Daniel Aldrich, Associate Professor of Political Science at Purdue University, author of Building Resilience, Social Capital in Post-Disaster Recovery. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.